59. He flips open the big suitcase. The screen is still on, showing him a flat desktop display with a menu bar at the top. He uses a trackball to pull down a menu. Help. Getting ready, firing reason, tactical tips, maintenance, resupply, troubleshooting, miscellaneous. Under the Getting Ready heading is more information than he could possibly want on that subject, including half an hour of badly overexposed video starring a stocky, scar-faced Asian guy whose face seems paralyzed into a permanent look of disdain. He puts on his clothes. He limbers up with special stretching exercises. He opens up Reason. He checks the barrels for damage or dirt. Hero fast-forwards through all of this. Finally, the stocky Asian man puts on the gun. Fisheye wasn't really using Reason the right way. It comes with its own mount that straps to your body so that you can soak up the recoil with your pelvis, taking the force right into your body's center of gravity. The mount has shock absorbers and miniature hydraulic goodies to compensate for the weight and the recoil. If you put all this stuff on the right way, the gun's a lot easier to use accurately. And if you're goggled into a computer, it'll superimpose a handy crosshairs over whatever the gun's aimed at. Your information, sir, the librarian says. Are you smart enough to tie that information into you are here? Hero says. I'll see what I can do, sir. The formats appear to be reconcilable. Sir? Yes? These blueprints are several years old. Since they were made, the Enterprise has been purchased by a private owner, who may have made some changes. Gotcha. Hero's back in reality. He finds an open boulevard of water that leads inward to the core. It has a sort of pedestrian catwalk running along one side of it, pieced together haphazardly, a seemingly endless procession of gangplanks, pontoons, logs, abandoned skiffs, aluminum canoes, oil drums. Anywhere else in the world, it would be an obstacle course. Here in the fifth world, it's a superhighway. Hero takes the boat straight down the middle, not very fast. If he runs into something, the boat might flip. Reason will sink, and Hero strapped onto Reason. Flipping into gargoyle mode, he can clearly make out a sparse picket line of hemispherical domes running along the edge of the Enterprise's flight deck. The radar gear thoughtfully identifies these on screen as the radar antennas of Phalanx anti-missile guns. Underneath each dome, a multi-barreled gun protrudes. He slows to a near stop and waves the barrel of Reason back and forth for a while until a crosshairs whips across his field of vision. That's the aiming point. He gets it settled down in the middle, right on one of those phalanx guns, and jerks the trigger for half a second. The big dome turns into a fountain of jagged, flaky debris. Underneath it, the gun barrels are still visible, speckled with a few red marks. Hero lowers the crosshairs a tad and fires another 50-round burst that cuts the gun loose from its mount. Then its ammunition belt starts to burst sporadically, and Hero has to look away. He looks at the next phalanx gun and finds himself staring straight down its barrels. That's so scary, he jerks the trigger involuntarily and fires a long burst that appears to do nothing at all. Then his view is obscured by something close up. The recoil has pushed him back behind a decrepit yacht tied up along the side of the channel. He knows what's going to happen next. The steam makes him easy to find, so he whips out of there. A second later, the yacht gets simply forced under the water by a burst from the big gun. Hero runs for a few seconds, finds a pontoon where he can steady himself, and opens up again with a long burst. When he's finished, the edge of the Enterprise has a jagged semicircular bite taken out of it where the phalanx gun used to be. He takes to the main channel again and follows it inward until it terminates beneath one of the core ships, a container ship converted into a high-rise apartment complex. A cargo net serves as a ramp from one to the other. It probably serves as a drawbridge also, when undesirables try to clamber up out of the ghetto. Hero is about as undesirable as anyone can be on the raft, but they leave the cargo net there for him. That's quite all right. He's staying on the little boat for now. He buzzes down the side of the container ship, makes a U-turn around its prow. The next vessel is a big oil tanker, mostly empty and riding high in the water. Looking up the sheer steel canyon separating the two ships, he sees no handy cargo nets stretched between them. They don't want thieves or terrorists to come up onto the tanker and drill for oil. The next ship is the Enterprise. The two giant vessels, the tanker and the aircraft carrier, ride parallel, anywhere from 10 to 50 feet apart, joined by a number of gigantic cables and held apart by huge airbags, like they squished a few blimps between them to keep them from rubbing. The heavy cables aren't just lashed from one ship to another. They've done something clever with weights and pulleys, he suspects, to allow for some slack when rough seas pull the ships opposite ways. Hero rides his own little airbag in between them. This gray steel tunnel is quiet and isolated compared to the raft. Except for him, no one has any reason to be here. For a minute, he just wants to sit there and relax. Which is not too likely when you think about it.
You are here, he says.
His view of the Enterprise's hull, a gently curved expanse of gray steel, turns into a three-dimensional wireframe drawing, showing him all the guts of the ship on the other side. Down here along the waterline, the Enterprise has a belt of thick anti-torpedo armor. It's not too promising. Farther up, the armor is thinner, and there's good stuff on the other side of it. Actual rooms instead of fuel tanks or ammunition holds. Hero chooses a room marked Ward Room and opens fire. The hull of the Enterprise is surprisingly tough. Reason doesn't just blow a crater straight through. It takes a few moments for the burst to penetrate. And then all it does is make a hole about 6 inches across. The recoil pushes Hero back against the rusted hull of the oil tanker. He can't take the gun with him anyway. He holds the trigger down and just tries to keep it aimed in a consistent direction until all the ammunition is gone. Then he unstraps it from his body and dumps the whole thing overboard. It'll go to the bottom and mark its position with a column of steam. Later, Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong can dispatch one of its environmental direct action posses to pick it up. Then they can haul Hero before the Tribunal of Environmental Crimes if they want to. Right now, he doesn't care. It takes half a dozen tries to secure the grappling hook in the jagged hole, 20 feet above the waterline. As he's wriggling through the hole, his coverall makes popping and hissing noises as the hot, sharp metal melts and tears through the synthetic material. He ends up leaving scraps of it behind, welded to the hull. He's got a few first and second degree burns on the parts of his skin that are now exposed, but they don't really hurt yet. That's how wound up he is. Later, they'll hurt. The soles of his shoes melt and sizzle as he treads on glowing hunks of shrapnel. The room is rather smoky, but aircraft carriers are nothing if not fire-conscious, and not too much in this place is flammable. Hero just walks through the smoke to the door, which has been carved into a steel doily by Reason. He kicks it out of its frame and enters a place that, in the blueprints, is simply marked Passageway. Then, because this seems as good a time as any, he draws his katana. When her partner is off doing something in reality, his avatar goes kind of slack. The body sits there like an inflatable love doll, and the face continues to go through all kinds of stretching exercises. She does not know what he's doing, but it looks like it must be exciting, because most of the time, he's either extremely surprised or scared shitless. Shortly after he gets done talking to the librarian dude about the aircraft carrier, she begins to hear deep rumbling noises, reality noises, from outside. Sounds like a cross between a machine gun and a buzzsaw. Whenever she hears that noise, Hero's face gets this astonished look like, I'm about to die. Someone is tapping her on the shoulder. Some suit who has an early morning appointment in the metaverse figures that whatever this courier is doing can't be all that important. She ignores it for a minute. Then Hero's office goes out of focus, jumps up in the air like it is painted on a window shade, and she's looking into the face of a guy, an Asian guy, a creep.
a wirehead, one of the scary antenna dudes.
Okay, she says. What do you want?
He grabs her by the arm and hauls her out of the booth. There's another one with him, and he grabs her other arm. They all start walking out of there.
Let go my fucking arm, she says. I'll go with you. It's okay.
It's not the first time she's been thrown out of a building full of suits. This time, it's a little different, though. This time, the bouncers are a couple of life-sized plastic action figures from Toys R Us. And it's not just that these guys probably don't speak English. They just don't act normal. She actually manages to twist one of her arms loose, and the guy doesn't smack her or anything. Just turns rigidly towards her and paws at her mechanically until he's got her by the arm again. No change in his face. His eyes stare like busted headlights. His mouth is open enough to let him breathe through it, but the lips never move, never change expression. They are in a complex of ship cabins and sliced open containers that acts as the lobby of the hotel. The wireheads drag her out of the door over the blunt crosshairs of the helipad. Just in time, too, because a chopper happens to be coming in for a landing. The safety procedures in this place suck. They could have got their heads chopped off. It is the slick corporate chopper with the Rare logo that she saw earlier. The wireheads try to drag her over a gangplank thingy that leads them across open water to the next ship. She manages to get turned around backward, grabs the railings with both hands, hooks her ankles into the stanchions, and hangs on. One of them grabs her around the waist from behind and tries to yank her body loose while the other one stands in front of her and pries her fingers loose, one at a time. Several guys are piling out of the Rare chopper. They are wearing coveralls with gear stuck into the pockets, and she sees at least one stethoscope. They haul big fiberglass cases out of the chopper with red crosses painted on their sides and run into the container ship. YT knows that this is not being done for the benefit of some fat businessman who stroked a lobe over his stewed prunes. They are going in there to reanimate her boyfriend. Raven, pumped, full of speed. Just what the world needs right now. They drag her across the deck of the next ship. From there, they take a stairway thingy up to the next ship after that, which is very big. She thinks it's an oil tanker. She can look across its broad deck through a tangle of pipes, rust seeping through white paint, and see the Enterprise on the other side. That's where they're going. There's no direct connection. A crane on the deck of the Enterprise has swung itself over to dangle a small wire cage over the tanker, just a few feet off the deck. It bobs up and down and glides back and forth over a fairly large area as the two ships rock in different ways and it swings like a pendulum at the end of its cable. It has a door on one side, which is hanging open. They sort of toss her into it head first, keeping her arms pinned to her side so she can't push it away from her, and then they spend a few seconds folding her legs in behind her. It's obvious by now that talking doesn't work, so she just fights silently. She manages to give one of them a good stomp to the bridge of the nose, and both feels and hears the bone break. But the man doesn't react in any way, other than snapping his head back on impact. She's so busy watching him, waiting to see when he's going to figure out that his nose is broken and that she's responsible for it, that she stops kicking and flailing long enough to get all shoved into the cage. Then the door snaps shut. An experienced raccoon could get the latch open. This cage isn't made to hold people. But by the time she gets her body worked around to the point where she can reach it, she's 20 feet above the deck, looking down on a lead of black water between the tanker and the Enterprise. Down below, she can see an abandoned Zodiac caroming back and forth between the steel walls. Not everything is exactly right on the Enterprise. Something is burning somewhere. People are firing guns. She's not entirely sure she wants to be there. As long as she is high up in the air, she reconnoiters the ship and confirms that there is no way off, no handy gangplanks or stairway thingies. She is being lowered toward the Enterprise. The cage is careening back and forth, skimming just over the deck on its cable, and when it finally touches the deck, it skids for a few feet before coming to a halt. She pops the latch and climbs out of there. Now what? There's a bullseye painted on the deck, a few helicopters parked around the edges and lashed down. And there is one helicopter, a mammoth twin-engine jet number, kind of a flying bathtub festooned with guns and missiles, sitting right in the middle of the bullseye, all of its lights on, engine whining, rotors spinning desultorily. A small cluster of men is standing next to it. YT walks toward it. She hates this. She knows this is exactly what she's supposed to do, but there really is no other choice. She wishes profoundly that she had her plank with her. The deck of this aircraft carrier is some of the best skating territory she has ever seen. She has seen in movies that carriers have big steam catapults for throwing airplanes into the sky. Think of what it would be like to ride a steam catapult on your plank. As she is walking toward the helicopter, one of the men standing by it detaches himself from the group and walks toward her. He's big, with a body like a 55-gallon drum, and a mustache that turns up at the corners. And as he comes toward her, he is laughing in a satisfied way, which pisses her off.
"Well, don't you look like a forlorn little thing," he says. "Shit, honey, you look like a drowned rat that got dried out again."
"Thanks," she says. "You look like chiseled spam."
"Very funny," he says.
"Then how come you're not laughing? Afraid it's true?"
"Look," he says, "I don't have time for this fucking adolescent banter. I grew up and got old specifically to get away from this."
"It's not that you don't have time," she says. "It's that you're not very good at it."
"You know who I am?" he asks.
"Yeah, I know. You know who I am?"
"YT, a 15-year-old courier,
and personal buddy of Uncle Enzo," she says, whipping off the string of dog tags and tossing them. He holds out one hand startled, and the chain whips around his fingers. He holds them up and reads them.
"Well, well," he says. "This is quite a little memento."
He throws them back at her.
"I know your buddies with Uncle Enzo. Otherwise, I just would have dunked you instead of bringing you here to my spread. And I frankly don't give a shit," he says, "because by the time this day is through, either Uncle Enzo will be out of a job, or else I'll be, as you said, chiseled spam. But I figure that the big wop will be a lot less likely to throw a stinger through the turbine of my chopper there if he knows his little Chiquita is on board."
"It's not like that," YT says. "It's not a relationship where fucking is part of it." But she is chagrined to learn that the dog tags, after all this time, did not have any magical effect on the bad guys. Rife turns around and starts walking back to the chopper. After a few steps, he turns back and looks at her, just standing there, trying not to cry.
"You coming?" he says.
She looks at the chopper, a ticket off the raft.
"Can I leave a note for Raven?"
"Far as Raven is concerned, I think you already made your point." "Come on, girl, we're wasting jet fuel over there. That ain't good for the goddamn environment."
She follows him to the chopper, climbs on board. It's warm and light inside here, with nice seats. Like coming in off a hard February day of thrashing the grittier highways and settling into a padded easy chair.
"Had the interior redone," Rife says. "This is a big old Sov gunship, and it wasn't made for comfort. But that's the price you pay for all that armor plating."
There's two other guys in here. One is about 50, sort of gaunt, big pores, wire-rimmed bifocals, carrying a laptop, a techie. The other is a bulky African-American with a gun.
"YT,"
says the always polite L. Bob Rife.
"Meet Frank Frost, my tech director, and Tony Michaels, my security chief."
"Ma'am,"
says Tony.
"Howdy," says Frank.
"Suck my toes," says YT.
"Don't step on that, please,"
Frank says. YT looks down. Climbing into the empty seat nearest the door, she has stepped on a package resting on the floor. It's about the dimensions of a phone book, but irregular, very heavy, swaddled in bubble pack and clear plastic. She can see glimpses of what's inside. Light reddish brown in color. covered with chicken scratches, hard as a rock.
What's that? YT says.
Homemade bread from Mom?
It's an ancient artifact, Frank says, all pissed off.
Rife chuckles, pleased and relieved that YT is now insulting someone else. Another man duck walks across the flight deck in mortal fear of the whirling rotor blades and climbs in. He's about 60, with a dirigible of white hair that was not ruffled in any way by the downdraft.
Hello, everyone, he says cheerfully. I don't think I've met all of you. Just got here this morning, and now I'm on my way back again.
Who are you? Tony says. The new guy looks crestfallen.
Greg Ritchie, he says.
Then, when no one seems to react, he jogs their memory.
President of the United States.
Oh! Sorry.
Nice to meet you, Mr. President, Tony says, extending his hand.
Tony Michaels.
Frank Frost, Frank says, extending his hand and looking bored.
Don't mind me, Whitey says, when Ritchie looks her way. I'm a hostage.
Torque this baby, Rife says to the pilot. Let's go to L.A. We got a mission to control.
The pilot has an angular face that, after her experiences on the raft, YT recognizes as typically Russian. He starts dicking with his controls. The engines whine louder, and the thwacking of the chopper blades picks up. YT feels but does not hear a couple of small explosions. Everyone else feels it too, but only Tony reacts. He crouches down on the floor of the chopper, pulls a gun out from under his jacket, and opens the door on his side. Meanwhile, the engines sigh back down in pitch, and the rotor coasts back down to an idle. YT can see him out the window. It's Hero. He's all covered with smoke and blood, and he's holding a pistol in one hand. He's just fired a couple of shots in the air to get their attention, and now he backs behind one of the parked choppers, taking cover.
You're a dead man, Rife shouts. You're stuck on the raft, asshole. I got a million myrmidons here. You gonna kill them all?
Swords don't run out of ammo, Hero shouts.
Well, what do you want?
I want the tablet. You give me the tablet, then you can take off and let your million wireheads kill me. You don't give me the tablet, I'm gonna empty this clip into the windshield of your chopper.
It's bulletproof, Rife says.
No, it isn't, Hero says, as the rebels in Afghanistan found out.
He is right, the pilot says.
Fucking Soviet piece of shit.
They put all that steel in its belly and then made the windshield out of glass?
Give me the tablet, Hero says, or I'm taking it.
No, you ain't, Rife says, 'cause I got Tinkerbell here.
At the last minute, YT tries to duck down and hide so he won't see her. She's ashamed. But Hero locks eyes with her for just a moment, and she can see the defeat come into his face. She makes a dive for the door and gets halfway out under the downblast of the rotors. Tony grabs her coverall's collar and hauls her back inside. He shoves her down on her belly and puts one knee in the small of her back to hold her there. Meanwhile, the engine is powering up again, and out the open door she can see the steel horizon of the carrier's deck drop from view. After all this time, she fucked up the plan. She owes Hero a refund. Or maybe not. She puts the heel of one hand against the edge of the clay tablet and shoves as hard as she can. It slides across the floor, teeters on the threshold, and spins out of the chopper. Another delivery made. Another satisfied customer. For a minute or so, the chopper hovers 20 feet overhead. All the people inside are staring down at the tablet, which has burst out of its wrappings in the middle of the bullseye. The plastic has torn apart around the corners, and fragments, large fragments of the tablet, have sprayed out for a few feet in either direction. Hero stares at it too, still safe behind the cover of a parked chopper. He stares at it so hard that he forgets to stare at anything else. Then a couple of wire heads land on his back, smashing his face into the flank of the chopper. He slides down and lands on his belly. His gun arm is still free, but a couple more wire heads sit on that. A couple on his legs, too. He can't move at all. He can't see anything but the broken tablet 20 feet away on the flight deck. The sound and wind of Rife's chopper diminish into a distant puttering noise that takes a long time to go away completely. He feels a tingling behind his ear, anticipating the scalpel and the drill. These wireheads are operating under remote control from somewhere else. Ing seemed to think that they had an organized RAF defense system. Maybe there's a hacker in charge, an N, sitting in the Enterprise's control tower, moving these guys around like an air traffic controller. In any case, they are not very big on spontaneity. They sit on him for a few minutes before they decide what to do next. Then, many hands reach down and clasp him around the wrists and ankles, elbows and knees. They haul him across the flight deck like pallbearers face up. Hero looks up into the control tower and sees a couple of faces looking down at him. One of them, the N, is talking into a microphone. Eventually, they come to a big flat elevator that sinks down into the guts of the ship, out of view of the control tower. It comes to rest on one of the lower decks, apparently a hangar deck where they used to maintain airplanes. Hero hears a woman's voice speaking words gently but clearly. Melulu mualnu umnemki me melulu mu mealnu umnealnu umeme me me mululu elulu medugamu mumuleyalu eme. It's 3 feet straight down to the deck, and he covers the distance in free fall, slamming down on his back, bumping his head. All his limbs bounce loosely on the metal. Around him he sees and hears the wireheads collapsing like wet towels falling off a rack. He cannot move any part of his body. He has a little control over his eyes. A face comes into view, and he has trouble resolving it, can't quite focus, but he recognizes something in her posture, the way she tosses her hair back over her shoulder when it falls down. It's Juanita. Juanita, with an antenna rising out of the base of her skull. She kneels down beside him, bends down, cups one hand around his ear, and whispers. The hot air tickles his ear. He tries to move away from it, but can't. She's whispering another long string of syllables. Then she straightens up and gooses him in the side. He jerks away from her. "Get up, lazy bones," she says. He gets up. He's fine now, but all the wireheads lay around him, perfectly motionless. "Just a little nam shub I whipped up," she says. "They'll be fine." "Hi," he says. "Hi. It's good to see you, Hero. I'm going to give you a hug now. Watch out for the antenna." She does. He hugs her back. The antenna's upside his nose, but that's okay. "Once we get this thing taken off, all the hair and stuff should grow back," she whispers. Finally, she lets him go. "That hug was really more for me than for you. It's been a lonely time here, lonely and scary." This is typically paradoxical behavior for Juanita, getting touchy-feely at a time like this. "Don't get me wrong," Hero says, "but aren't you one of the bad guys now?" "Oh, you mean this?" "Yeah. Don't you work for them?" "If so, I'm not doing a very good job," she laughs, gesturing at the ring of motionless wireheads. "No, this doesn't work on me. It sort of did for a while, but there are ways to fight it." "Why? Why doesn't it work on you?" "I've spent the last several years hanging around with Jesuits," she says. "Look, your brain has an immune system just like your body. The more you use it, the more viruses you get exposed to, the better your immune system becomes. And I've got a hell of an immune system. Remember, I was an atheist for a while, and then I came back to religion the hard way." "Why didn't they screw you up the way they did David?"
"I came here voluntarily."
"Like Inanna?"
"Yes."
"Why would anyone come here voluntarily?"
"Hero, don't you realize? This is it. This is the nerve center of a religion that is at once brand new and very ancient. Being here is like following Jesus or Muhammad around, getting to observe the birth of a new faith.
But it's terrible. Rife is the Antichrist, Hero says.
Of course he is, but it's still interesting.
And Rife has got something else going for him.
Eridu.
The city of Enki, Hero says.
Exactly. He's got every tablet Enki ever wrote. For a person who's interested in religion and hacking, this is the only place in the world to be.
If those tablets were in Arabia, I'd put on a chador and burn my driver's license and go there.
But the tablets are here, and so I let them wire me up instead.
So all this time, your goal was to study Enki's tablets.
To get the Mei, just like Inanna. What else?
And have you been studying them?
Oh, yes.
And?
She points to the fallen wireheads. And I can do it now. I'm a Baal Shem. I can hack the brainstem.
Okay, look. I'm happy for you, Juanita. But at the time being, we have a little problem. We are surrounded by a million people who want to kill us. Can you paralyze all of them?
Yes, she says. But then they die.
You know what we have to do, don't you, Juanita?
Release the Namshub of Enki, she says. Do the Babel thing.
Let's go get it, Hero says.
First things first, Juanita says. The control tower.
Okay. You get ready to grab the tablet, and I'll take out the control tower.
How are you going to do that? By cutting people up with swords?
Yeah. That's the only thing they're good for.
Let's do it the other way around, Juanita says.
She gets up and walks off across the hangar deck. The Namshub of Enki is a tablet wrapped up in a clay envelope covered with the cuneiform equivalent of a warning sticker. The entire assembly has shattered into dozens of pieces. Most of them have stayed wrapped up inside the plastic, but some have gone spinning across the flight deck. Hero gathers them up from the helipad and returns them to the center. By the time he's got the plastic wrapper cut away, Juanita is waving to him from the windows on top of the control tower. He takes all the pieces that look to be part of the envelope and puts them into a separate pile. Then he assembles the remains of the tablet itself into a coherent group. It's not obvious yet how to piece them together, and he doesn't have time for jigsaw puzzles. So he goggles into his office, uses the computer to take an electronic snapshot of the fragments, and calls the librarian.
Yes, sir.
This hypercard contains a picture of a shattered clay tablet. Do you know of some software that would be good at piecing it back together?
One moment, sir,
the librarian says. Then a hypercard appears in his hand. He gives it to Hero. It contains a picture of an assembled tablet.
That's how it looks, sir.
Can you read Sumerian?
Yes, sir.
Can you read this tablet out loud?
Yes, sir.
Get ready to do it. And hold on a second. Hero walks over to the base of the control tower. There's a door there that gives him access to a stairwell. He climbs up to the control room, a strange mixture of Iron Age and high-tech. Juanita's waiting there, surrounded by peacefully slumbering wireheads. She taps a microphone that is projecting from a communications panel at the end of a flexible gooseneck. The same mic that the N was speaking into.
Live to the raft, she says. Go for it.
Hero puts his computer into speakerphone mode and stands up next to the microphone. Librarian, read it back, he says. And a string of syllables pours out of the speaker. In the middle of it, Hero glances up at Juanita. She's standing in the far corner of the room with her fingers stuck in her ears. Down at the base of the stairs, a wirehead begins to talk. Deep down inside the Enterprise, there's more talking going on. And none of it makes any sense. It's just a lot of babbling. There's an external catwalk on the control tower. Hero goes out there and listens to the raft. From all around them comes a dim roar, not of waves or wind, but of a million unchained human voices speaking in a confusion of tongues. Juanita comes out to listen too. Hero sees a trickle of red under her ear. You're bleeding, he says.
I know.
A little bit of primitive surgery, she says. Her voice is strained and uncomfortable. I've been carrying around a scalpel blade for cases like this.
What did you do?
Slid it up under the base of the antenna and cut the wire that goes into my skull, she says.
When did you do that?
While you were down on the flight deck.
Why?
Why do you think? She says. So I wouldn't be exposed to the Namshub of Enki. I'm a neurolinguistic hacker now, Hero. I went through hell to obtain this knowledge. It's a part of me. Don't expect me to submit to a lobotomy.
If we get out of this, will you be my girl?
Naturally, she says. Now let's get out of it.
Amalakin sabantam gan nunkari. 55.
62.
I was just doing my job, man, she says. This Enki dude wanted to get a message to Hero, and I delivered it.
Shut up, Rife says. He doesn't say it like he's pissed. He just wants her to be quiet. Because what she did doesn't make any difference now that all those wire heads have piled on top of Hero.
YT looks out the window. They are buzzing across the Pacific, keeping pretty low down so that the water skims quickly beneath them. She doesn't know how fast they're going, but it looks to be pretty damn fast. She always thought the ocean was supposed to be blue, but in fact, it's the most boring gray color she's ever seen. And there's miles and miles of it. After a few minutes, another chopper catches up with them and begins flying alongside, pretty close, in formation. It's the rare chopper, the one full of medics. Through its cabin window, she can see Raven sitting in one of the seats. At first, she thinks he's still unconscious because he's kind of hunched over, not moving. Then he lifts his head and she sees that he's goggled into the metaverse. He reaches up with one hand and pulls the goggles up onto his forehead for a moment, squints out the window, and sees her watching him.
Their eyes meet, and her heart starts flopping around weakly, like a bunny in a Ziploc bag.
He grins and waves. YT sits back in her seat and pulls the shade down over the window.
From Hero's front yard to Elbob Rife's black cube at port 127 is halfway around the metaverse, a distance of 32,768 kilometers. The only hard part, really, is getting out of downtown. He can ride his bike straight through the avatars as usual, but the street is also cluttered with vehicles, animercials, commercial displays, public plazas, and other bits of solid-looking software that get in his way. Not to mention a few distractions. Off to his right, about a kilometer away from the black sun, is a deep hole in the hyper-Manhattan skyline. It is an open plaza about a mile wide, a park of sorts, where avatars can gather for concerts and conventions and festivals. Most of it is occupied by a deep-dish amphitheater that is capable of seating close to 1 million avatars at once. Down at the bottom is a huge circular stage. Normally the stage is occupied by major rock groups. Tonight, it is occupied by the grandest and most brilliant computer hallucinations that the human mind can invent. A three-dimensional marquee hangs above it, announcing tonight's event. A benefit graphics concert staged on behalf of David Meyer, who is still hospitalized with an inexplicable disease. The amphitheater is half-filled with hackers. Once he gets out of downtown, Hero twists his throttle up to the max and covers the remaining 32,000 and some kilometers in the space of about 10 minutes. Over his head, the express trains are whooshing down the track at a metaphorical speed of 10,000 miles per hour. He passes them like they're standing still. This only works because he's riding in an absolutely straight line. He's got a routine coded into his motorcycle software that makes it follow the monorail track automatically so that he doesn't even have to worry about steering it. Meanwhile, Juanita's standing next to him in reality. She's got another pair of goggles. She can see all the same things that Hero sees. Rife's got a mobile uplink on his corporate chopper, just like the one on commercial airliners, so he can patch into the metaverse when he's in the air.
As long as he's airborne, that's his only link to the metaverse. We may be able to hack our way into that one link and block it or something.
That low-level communication stuff is too full of medicine for us to mess with it in this decade, Hiro says, breaking his motorcycle to a stop. Holy shit. It's just like Wyatt he described it. He's in front of Port 127. Rife's black cube is there, just as Wyatt he described it. There's no door. Hiro starts walking away from the street toward the cube. It reflects no light at all, so he can't tell whether it's 10 feet or 10 miles away from him until the security demons begin to materialize. There are half a dozen of them, all big, sturdy avatars in blue coveralls, sort of quasi-military-looking, but without rank. They don't need rank, because they're all running the same program. They materialize around him in a neat semicircle with a radius of about 10 feet, blocking Hiro's way to the cube. Hiro mumbles a word under his breath and vanishes. He slips into his invisible avatar. It would be very interesting to hang around and see how these security demons deal with it, but right now he has to get moving before they get a chance to adjust. They don't, at least not very well. Hiro runs between two of the security demons and heads for the wall of the cube. He finally gets there, slamming into it, coming to a dead stop. The security demons have all turned around and are chasing him. They can figure out where he is. The computer tells them that much, but they can't do much to him. Like the bouncer demons in the Black Sun, which Hiro helped write, they shove people around by applying basic rules of avatar physics. When Hiro is invisible, there is very little for them to shove. But if they are well written, they may have more subtle ways of messing him up so he's not wasting any time. He pokes his katana through the side of the cube and follows it through the wall and out the other side. This is a hack. It is really based on a very old hack, a loophole that he found years ago when he was trying to graft the sword fighting rules onto the existing metaverse software. His blade doesn't have the power to cut a hole in the wall. This would mean permanently changing the shape of someone else's building, but it does have the power to penetrate things. Avatars do not have that power. That is the whole purpose of a wall in the metaverse. It is a structure that does not allow avatars to penetrate it. But like anything else in the metaverse, this rule is nothing but a protocol, a convention that different computers agree to follow. In theory, it cannot be ignored, but in practice, it depends upon the ability of different computers to swap information very precisely, at high speed, and at just the right times. And when you are connected to the system over a satellite uplink, as Hiro is, out here on the raft, there is a delay as the signals bounce up to the satellite and back down. That delay can be taken advantage of if you move quickly and don't look back. Hiro passes right through the wall on the tail end of his all-penetrating katana.